Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and today I'm here with David Dayan. David is the executive editor of The American Prospect. His work has appeared in The Intercept, The New Republic, HuffPost, The Washington Post, The LA Times, and many, many other newspapers and journals. His first book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, was published by the New Press in 2016 and won the Studs and Ida Terkel Prize. Today, we're here to discuss his brand new book, also published by the New Press, Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power. David, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So would you just start by letting our listeners know what your book is about and a little bit about the situation with monopoly that we all face today?
Yeah, sure. So over the last half decade, there's been sort of a resurgence of thinking and some literature around this pretty obvious reality that fewer and fewer corporations have more and more control over various sectors of the economy. They've been focused on history. They've been focused on just the mechanics of monopoly, various market shares. Some have looked at very particular sectors like the tech industry. What I thought was missing from all of that was going out and talking to people about how this affects them in their daily lives. So back when you could actually travel, wasn't that fun? I did and went around to various parts of the country and just sort of took almost a travel log of monopoly. So I went to Iowa and I talked to farmers who are struggling with big ag. I went to Tennessee and talked to people in rural areas who can't get broadband because telecom companies prevent municipal broadband from happening. I talked to people in Ohio who are dealing with opioid epidemic. Talked to journalists in New York. I talked to people struggling with the health system, struggling with private equity, struggling with prison monopolies. Talked to a woman in North Carolina about that. The idea was to collect all these sources and see how these people who, come from different backgrounds. I talked to Trump supporters. I talked to Republicans, libertarians, liberals, all have this sense that there is something wrong with our economy, that there is this control that has been given over to these large corporations. They may not be able to describe it technically in terms of monopoly. They may not be able to use the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index that talks about, market shares and things like that. But they know something is wrong, that the game is rigged, as Elizabeth Warren is fond of saying. So I really wanted to get at that and how it affects people, not just we have to pay more because there's only one cable company in town. How it affects them as workers, how it affects them as innovators and entrepreneurs, how it affects them as citizens in a democracy where economic power is converted into political power. So I wanted to look at it from all of those different angles, and this was the result.
Well, I think that, as you point out, most of us do know in some ways the way, that monopoly affects us. I mean, you start, chapter one, very sensible given probably a lot of your readership, it's on the airlines, right? It's something very visceral that many of us experienced, especially those of us who, traveled for 20 years. It's a different world in many ways than it was then, and not only because of the security and post 9/11, but simply because of what the airlines have done and the level of discomfort and all of this. But what are some of the other ways in which we are affected by monopoly that we might not even know?
Yeah, I mean, I think the airlines is a perfect example. So all of the things that I talk about in the book can be seen in that instance. As you say, they've created this forced discomfort And then if you want to pay a little bit more, you can get back to the place that you were 20 years ago in the normal area. So it's a quality problem. And because four companies control 80% of the routes, and if you're in a smaller regional area, usually you have one choice. There's no incentive to make it any better. And in fact, there are incentives to make it actively worse. So that's one example. Another is the hidden risk that is caused by monopolies. So in the older days, when there were a lot of competition around airlines, if the computer system for one of them went down, then you could book on another plane. In fact, there were reciprocal agreements. There were ways for the airlines to manage that situation so nobody was inconvenienced. Now, if United Airlines or American Airlines computer system goes down, and it goes down routinely because they've all been merged together with other systems because of these endless mergers, and they're put together with spit and tape. So if they break down, there's no choice for a lot of people, for number one. And the reciprocal agreements have broken down because these companies have so much power that they don't want to give up a very lucrative seat. So where once nobody was inconvenienced, now it's tens of thousands of travelers. So that hidden risk that comes in that magnifies disruptions, that's a function of monopoly. The fact that we couldn't change the tarmac rule, which said that we just want to be able to get off this plane within 3 hours if we're stuck on the tarmac, or the seat pitch rule, which says that you have a modicum of comfort between you and the person in front of you. That was all because of political machinations from the airline trade lobbies, which is the big carriers, to prevent changes at the federal level under Democrats and Republicans. This has caused an epidemic of deep vein thrombosis on these flights, which is a medical condition that creates blood clots because you're stuck in a long haul flight in a really awkward position for hours on end. So that, you know, this health disaster is sort of a function of monopoly, you can see. So, I mean, I think airlines is a really good way to sort of get into this whole thing and show that this is about more than just price.
You know, one thing as a historian that I'm interested about thinking about our position right now, and, you know, I've been for a decade probably, I've been calling this the new Gilded Age, and other people have used that kind of terminology as well. And I want to think about a little bit, your book doesn't go into a lot of history for obvious reasons, but, you know, I think that I want to talk about that just a little bit. And I'm wondering if you would, what your thoughts are about the ways in which monopoly works today compared to the initial Gilded Age. Because when we think of monopoly in America, we tend to think of, you know, railroads, or the steel industry, or oil, in those, you know, in that epic period between 1870 and 1930, and I'm just wondering what your thoughts are in terms of comparing the two eras.
Yeah, I mean it's really interesting to compare them, and I feel like I was liberated from having to do that because there were other books out there that covered this subject matter. So. But it's true. You know, the progressive era, we had railroads, which were really the carriers of information and commerce in a way that technology companies are today. We had oil companies, which, you know, were the drivers of a lot of transportation and commerce as well. Again, you can see parallels there. And what ended up happening in the progressive era, and I'm dumbing it down a little bit, but there was a farmer movement, a labor movement, a small business movement in some senses, that sort of coalesced and brought the progressive era forward and created the political pressure to put these laws in place that we're still using today, the Sherman Antitrust Act, the Clayton Antitrust Act, the Federal Trade Commission Act. Those set the framework for how we dealt with monopolies, and then more were put on afterwards. But it was really a political movement that created the impetus to get that done. And then what happened is that the movement sort of dissipated, the laws stayed in place, but a counter-reformation, almost a counter-movement on the right, led by Robert Bork and folks at the University of Chicago, reinterpreted those progressive era antitrust laws, really without changing a word, just reinterpreted them to say that any merger is allowable as long as the result of that merger is more efficient and promotes consumer welfare, which in their conception means just prices. The corollary to that is that Bork often said that any merger of two companies would create efficiencies. So it was a perfectly circular argument, like he's saying that if these two companies come together, it's more efficient. And if it's more efficient, you can't stop the merger. So yeah, the QED. That really took hold around 1980. I mean, the Reagan administration came in, they changed the antitrust Department of Justice guidelines. And for the last 40 years, we've sort of been living under that reality. Now, in the last half decade or so, we're starting to see the stirrings of a new anti-monopoly movement that potentially could create the momentum to either reinterpret those laws or create new laws that deal with the particular circumstances of the 21st century and reverse this damage that has been done over the last 40 years. So it's really cyclical, and it's interesting to study from that aspect.
You know, one thing I was thinking about when reading your book and in comparing past to present is I almost wonder if our monopoly problem is not bigger now than it was in the Gilded Age. And perhaps I'm oversimplifying some things, particularly the sort of Gilded Age culture, but that, you know, yes, you had railroads and mines and these big, you know, giant industries that were monopolized, but then you had whole, you know, sectors of the economy that really weren't. And, you know, what you don't have then that you have now, and, you know, you get into this talking about Warren Buffett, who plays a big role in your book, is that, you know, these companies have their, you know, to use the old Gilded Age animal comparison, you know, they have their octopus tentacles everywhere in the economy in all kinds of hidden ways that didn't exist in the kind of classic era of, you know, horizontal or vertical integration as it's commonly taught. And then secondarily, you know, you talk about the rise of a new kind of movement to fight monopoly. And I certainly agree that intellectually there's been a lot of work that's been done over the last decade around this that's very valuable, and your book's a huge contributor to that. But, you know, as you point out, the populists, the labor movement, other kinds of movements, then, you know, there's not an easy comparison to now. You know, I think that part of the problem that we face generally, and things are starting to move in the right direction, and they haven't now for some years, but that there was a much greater organizing culture, a much greater political culture of people being in touch with each other in a very physical manner 100 years ago than there is today. And so we're kind of, corporations have sort of moved, you know, eons ahead while we're kind of still figuring out how to organize again. And so those are a couple of thoughts I had reading your book that maybe, again, we're in a worse position now vis-a-vis monopoly than we were in the Gilded
Age. Yeah, I mean, you covered a lot of territory there. So let me try to just sort of break it down. First of all, on the sort of illusion of choice, the idea of these tentacles that go out. I think, you know, in the Gilded Age, you had local shopkeepers pretty much universally. There wasn't really a chain store movement at that moment. It came a little bit later. The A&P was sort of the big one that became this sort of big supermarket grocery chain. But interestingly there, so A&P at its height in the early 1930s was, 16% of all the grocery market in the United States. You can find, there was an Institute for Local Self-Reliance report about Walmart that showed that in 200 metropolitan areas, Walmart is responsible for over 50% of all grocery sales. And overall, nationally, it's a one quarter. So it's bigger than A&P was at its peak. And A&P at its peak caused massive antitrust lawsuits and consent decrees and things like that. So in some sense, yes, it is bigger. The sort of illusion of choice, I mean, in going through this book, even in actually just taking the steps to travel around in this book, I found all of these weird situations that were, redolent of monopoly and how and how you don't even know that it's happening. I was in an airport and I went to the rental car counter. It was an enterprise rental car counter. And the lady behind, after I finished the paperwork, said, okay, hold on one second. She walked out of the counter, went to the national rental car counter, took a pair of keys out of the bowl from National Rent a Car, went back to the Enterprise counter and gave me the key. And what I learned was that Enterprise and National is the same corporate parent, and apparently the same keys in this particular airport. I had similar situations like that almost throughout the entire process, and it just showed me that we think we have choices, but we actually don't. So as far as whether we're equipped to really handle this relative to the past, I mean, the good news is that you don't have to necessarily pass new legislation, right? I mean, the legislation is there, a lot of it anyway, not all of it. And what's lacking is sort of political will. Now, obviously, political will is the ball game, right? I mean, that's kind of everything. But, it's not a situation where we have to devise, how are we going to structure this and what are the guidelines going to be? We have the legislation and we can follow the rules, the original intent of John Sherman and the Sherman Act and things like that. I was, pretty inspired by the work of someone who's in your community, David Cicilline, and the House Antitrust Subcommittee, which held a hearing with the CEOs of the four largest tech corporations, Amazon, Google, Facebook, and Apple, and really showed a deep insight into the workings of these companies and had them sort of scrambling to answer to these charges. And they're going to put out a report in the fall that is, I think, going to be a blueprint for how to deal with monopoly in the tech sector. But, you can apply that more broadly. We have an election coming up. We could see a democratic restoration. This blueprint will be a yardstick by which to judge that potential incoming administration and incoming Congress on these issues. It will include how enforcement can be better targeted by the existing agencies. It'll include some legislative actions. It will speak to the personnel that you need at those agencies in order to have a more aggressive posture. So it will be sort of the Bible for how you figure out how to handle this problem. And I don't think there's one way. I mean, one thing that's interesting is there's antitrust and there's also anti-monopoly. So antitrust is really about mergers, divestitures, breaking them up, all of those kind of things. And those are really located in two agencies, the Federal Trade Commission and the Antitrust Division of the Justice Department. There are anti-monopoly laws that are all throughout the government, the FCC, the Defense Department, a host of them. And they can be, rules on common carrier relationships. They can be rules on structural separations. If you're in this business line, you can't be in this business line. There are an endless amount of these kinds of things that happen not only at the federal level, but also at the state and local level. Some of them are public options, alternatives, community broadband, a public bank. There are anti-chain store laws and anti you know, there are zoning laws against dollar stores in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You know, if you can do it there, right? There's a law that says you have to be an independent individual if you run a pharmacy in North Dakota. There are a lot of options here, and I think the combination of this new anti-monopoly movement and the foothold that it's gained within the Democratic Party are going to be critical to determine whether these ideas spread both at the state level and at the federal
level. Well, and that, you know, I was going to kind of save this question until the end, but I think it's worth talking about now, which is, you know, what can we expect from a potential Biden administration? I mean, I think that like a lot of people involved in economic policy work and, you know, in pushing for progressive economics, Joe Biden really was not my first choice or even my fifth. But it's where we're at. You know, I think I've kind of come to you know, grips with that. But, you know, Biden was notoriously, you know, the senator from Citibank. So what at the same time you talk about David Cicilline and Elizabeth Warren and other politicians that really have moved to reinvigorate this on a policy level. So what do you think we might see from a Biden administration on these issues?
Well, I mean, I think left to his own devices, the outcome would probably not be terribly great. Although there, you know, there's always the thing about corporations who, you know, the idea that corporations taking on other corporations might get you a favorable result by accident, right? Biden is very tied to Comcast, and Comcast hates Google and all those companies. So you might get something just out of that relationship. Someone who's very close to Biden is a woman named Terrell McSweeney, who was a commissioner on the Federal Trade Commission, who is now at a big-time corporate defense firm named Covington & Burling. And during her time, she sided with Uber against the city of Seattle when they were trying to get workers, you know, unionized, rideshare workers in that city. So I wouldn't have high hopes there. However, you know, he's not going to be left to his own devices. He's going to have a lot of pressure from progressive elements, and particularly on these issues, a very dedicated and concerted effort. I wrote a feature called Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Biden for the Prospect, seeing like who are we going to get? What are we going to get from a potential Biden administration? And one of the points I made in that, and that was actually a historical point, so maybe this will interest you, is I talk about the Glass-Steagall Act. And the Glass-Steagall Act today is thought of as this groundbreaking progressive legislation that it's an anti-monopoly law. It separated commercial investment banks and made sure that those supermarket banks didn't get too big. Carter Glass, who is the namesake of the Glass-Steagall Act, was a right-wing Democrat from Virginia who was completely in the pocket of the banking sector. I mean, like 100%. It was whatever the banking sector said is what he did. He was the chair of the Senate Banking Committee at the time. And so how is his name on this huge progressive reform? Well, it turned out that Glass-Steagall was the compromise. What the people wanted at that time, there's a great book on this called Money, Power, and the People by a guy named Christopher Shaw, who's out of UC Berkeley. He lists in really heavy detail what the conversation was in the country at the time about banks. And the conversation was, we don't want them anymore. Like, the conversation was, we want to nationalize the entire banking sector, and there should be no private banks anywhere in this country. There was a resolution in West Virginia. This is right after the Depression, right after the stock market crash, that said the head of any failing bank should be beheaded. This was like in the West Virginia legislature. Right. So there was this extreme seething hatred of the banking sector, such that Carter Glass, the right-wing banking stooge, had to come up with a compromise solution to keep them at bay. And what he came up with was structural separation, Glass-Steagall. And then Henry Steagall, who was the chair of the House Financial Services Committee, more of a populist Democrat, he joined with him on this. So that shows you that the ideology and character of the individuals who we put into office in certain moments does not always carry the day. And this, the pandemic, I think, is maybe one of those moments where you can see such sort of grassroots participation and demands that it forces the political system to act. So, I mean, it remains to be seen if that will happen, but there's a blueprint for that happening, and I think it's around the time of the New Deal and Glass-Steagall.
Yeah, well, that kind of leads into what I think should be our last question, because I don't want to keep you too long, which is, you know, your book comes out right as a global pandemic hits, and by nearly all accounts that I've read, you know, the economy of the pandemic has been massively helpful to monopolies. That this situation has gotten much worse in the last 6 months, significantly worse. I was wondering if you could talk about that and maybe as a way to close out where you see these issues, you know, 10, 20 years from now. What's your vision of the future?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The pandemic has accelerated this trend that has been in evidence for the last 40 years for a variety of reasons. Number one, simply, you know, small businesses have far less reserves to survive widespread economic pain than big companies do. And so, you know, you see small businesses failing at in high numbers, and those that are left simply gain more market share. The second reason is that the way that the congressional rescue was structured, the CARES Act, tended to benefit bigger businesses disproportionately relative to small ones. The bigger businesses got the benefit of this, what I've called the Federal Reserve money cannon, this $4.5 trillion capacity that almost has just been shown rather than deployed. It's kind of like showing your gun and then putting it away, and that was enough to keep the stock market inflated, keep asset prices up, keep corporate bond spreads very low. Whereas small business support was time limited. It was 8 weeks of payroll support. We're now 5 months into the pandemic. It just wasn't enough. So that sort of imbalance has helped big businesses. And then sort of the trends of how we're living our lives benefits certain large businesses very much. Amazon for delivery and Google tools for working from home and you know, the fact that we're all home and Facebook is having record readership and things like that. So, I mean, it's really extreme. I believe four or five tech firms now are responsible in terms of valuation for 20% of the S&P 500. We've not seen almost anything like this in the past. So this is definitely accelerating. Another stat that I read just recently is that six companies are responsible for about 33% of all retail sales, which is absolutely astonishing. So it's absolutely a problem, but it's not a problem that is unfixable. It may look like that right now, but we have the power and ability to say that because of all these associated harms, because of the harms to workers who don't have different companies to go to bargain for their labor, because of the problems on innovation, entrepreneurship, small business formation is at half the levels that it was 40 years ago, because of the impact on politics and regional inequality in these abandoned communities where all the value gets sucked out and goes to these monopolists. We have the choice to structure public policy in a way that makes sure that these external harms are limited, mitigated, and eliminated. And it just takes, as we said before, political will. Now, obviously, that's a huge ballgame-like proposition. But, you know, I do think that there is a foothold right now. It's small. It's growing. It's going to take time. But usually these things take a long time, and then everything changes in a blink. The example I give in the last chapter of the book is of Israel. Of all places, where they had a worse monopoly problem than we did. And there was a very nascent movement started by a journalist with a news outlet called The Marker that finally started to talk about these monopoly issues, which really weren't talked about within Israel either. It went along for about 5, 6, 7 years and didn't do much. And then in 2011, there were these mass protests in Israel. They first started because of high food prices and high housing prices, but they gradually, you know, sort of glommed on to this critique of monopolists and tycoons that this small group had been making for many, many years. And they took on the character of that anti-monopoly movement. And it was a tremendously large protest. You're talking about 500,000 people at its peak in a country of, I believe, 8 to 10 million. That is an amazing number. And it did force the political system to act. And there was this anti-concentration law under Benjamin Netanyahu, right? Not a left-wing radical. This anti-concentration law comes in place. And one example is that cell phones in Israel dropped the service charges on them, dropped 90% almost overnight. A lot of these tycoons who were controlling the economy through interlocking directorates and things like that, a lot of them went to jail. And so, you know, that was an example of a slow burn, and then everything changes in a minute. And so, I'm not predicting that to happen in the United States, but the potential is there.
Well, and I think that's a good hopeful way to end. And I think that's true in terms of all kinds of political movements, that people are always fighting for things. And then all of a sudden it happens for, you know, whatever reason, sometimes it's unknown, but you know, that's right. A very good point. Massive change can happen very quickly. Well, once again, we've been talking to David Dayan about his new book, Monopolized: Life in the Age of Corporate Power, published this year by the New Press. David, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me and for your interest.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,